Closure, Part 2. My epigraph is a stanza from an Emily Dickinson poem, one I converted into a song a couple of years ago. Wild nights, were I with thee, wild nights should be our luxury. I never listen to music when I walk in the forest, but today I did. I just got a set of wireless earbuds I wanted to try out. Almost offhandedly, I picked the album of songs I composed and recorded based on some of Emily Dickinson's poems. In retrospect, I see it was almost an inevitable choice in that my experience of being in the company of Emily Dickinson, when my head is right, is exactly the one I felt in the forest today. Several years ago, as I explain in This Fall, I suddenly knew that she and I were on the same page when it came to the most consequential human matters, those pertaining to intimacy and love especially. Two themes that may seem quite removed from her poetic sphere most of the time, but that are everywhere in it. Its context, much like the last 10 days are the context for my walk today. If you listen long enough with open ears, either speaking or singing her poems, each one more a synthetic sonic field, a lucid aura, than a laborious constructed puzzle of gnomic words. You have to get her poems the way you get a joke. In an email exchange with a friend discussing the experience of getting a joke or a poem, and especially another person, she described that flash of sudden understanding, nothing to everything at once, as an instant, joyful shock. Exactly. Experiencing that moment with anyone, including Emily Dickinson, may require many installments of preliminary work, some of them challenging. But until you reach the point where the whole is illuminated suddenly in its all-at-onceness, you haven't gotten there. The way today's walk suddenly illuminated all the thinking I've been doing over the last 10 days, many separate layers or stages, all coalescing, an instant, joyful shock. I was talking with another friend a few days ago about time, the ways in which we are culturally habituated to imagine its forward-oriented passage. A behind-the-scenes indoctrination that is so hard to find a way out of, even when you realize how inane and dysfunctional it is. I talked for a while about the differences between Newton and Einstein in that regard, the fundamentally contrary ways they orchestrate space vis-a-vis time, about weird and amazing St. Augustine trying to parse out past, present, and future nearly 2 millennia ago. About the highly contested current trope of the frozen river of time that inflects so many of the maddeningly simplistic arguments among contemporary physicists about temporality. And then about my own more amicable ways of construing this foundational matrix for human experience. In Their Arrow versus My Froth of Bubbles, for example, I outline my alternative to the currently preferred metaphor for the directionality of time. In All the Time in the World, I write about the salutary effects that derive from imaginatively reversing the customary vector of time. In Harvest, Essays on Time from Olympia, I write, among other things, about the phantom thespian I believe we all share as an agent for quantum entanglement with the universe, and the vanishingly thin vestige of the approaching future we live in, right now and right now. My bottom line is simply that time must be just as strange and arcane as quantum theorists now tell us space is. The right minds just haven't taken the time to think about it rightly. I ended up talking with my friend about those special moments in life, like today's walk for me, like any moment when I feel truly sane in this loony world, Or is it vice versa? In that rigorously parsed out sentence of time, fixed past behind a static noun, negotiable present here, a fleeting verb, empty future ahead, just beyond a vague conjunction, suddenly collapses to a singularity. The way they say that under certain circumstances, like a near-death experience, a whole life can flash before our eyes, an instant joyful shock, are finally getting it. Here's the last paragraph from the essay portion of this fall, which describes one such experience of this beautiful conundrum. I said, last spring, I was the luckiest man in the world for the 32 years I got to spend with Carol. And then I wasn't. Now I know I still am. What's not there and what is was how I divided things up back then. Now it's what's not there and still is. Time is a delusion. Our conventional ways of orchestrating it, all that coming and going, then and gone, perpetual sequence, silly. It's all there, now. Everything, everything now. I know that, here, now, the top of the world, this great green field, sun so bright, blue sky, my arms raised to the heavens, all the leaves down, the elephants settling down for winter, dreaming their dreams or mine. Love everything, they're saying. Yes. Love. Everything. Time is not a frozen river, not an endless sequence of equal seconds metered off by a clock, not a scarce, inimical resource scourging us forward, not a life sentence or a life of sentences that we are compelled simply to complete or to endure. It is malleable, friendly, a wide open field in which we can play our gentlest and sanest games together. It is, above all, I have come to believe, a vital, generative expression of love that inspires the whole universe, breathing life into time and vice versa. And at certain perfect moments, when we are both here and there and everywhere at once, we understand that all the dimensions of time are always all there, all together, all at once, for us, too. When I got to the bay, I realized that today was one of those rare ultra-king tide days. The water, having receded all the way out past the remnants of the long-abandoned lumber-dumping railroad trestle that is usually 30 to 50 yards away from shore, with 8 to 15 feet of water around it, unapproachable by foot. Today, the pathway out was not only waterless, which it sometimes is, but too mucky to walk through, but terra firma, several feet above water. So I walked out there, into and among the many telephone pole-sized timbers that provide its foundation, barnacles a foot thick on some of them, until that matrix became too mazy to pass through without a lot of bodily contortions. The signage on shore says that many thousands of bats come to roost there and pup around this time of year, running back and forth in great hordes to Olympia at dawn and dusk. I've never been out there at either dawn or dusk, the opening closing times of the parking lot, and I couldn't see them hanging out under the dark rail deck today either, 20 feet overhead, though they may have been up there sleeping. My way back to the car was walkabout wonderful, a meandering meet and greet with many of my favorite Woodard Bay entities. The bald eagle I see from time to time, circling slowly overhead today, like a little boat afloat on a big blue sky on its way to nowhere in particular, the way I was on the ground below. The majestic ancient crab tree, a rare, maybe unique tree in these woods, which have no such understory trees, just huge aerial overlords and vast savannas of ground-bound ferns, its 50-foot-wide umbrella of branches extending all the way to the ground all around. So much so that this time of year, leafed out, you have to already know the few little portals through which you can enter that magical canopy. So quiet, dry when it's raining, and peacefully private. At the base of the tree is an arrangement of 5 soccer ball-sized stones I carried up from the shore last summer to mark this special spot. When I turned to leave that day, I could see that they looked like an angel. Head, midriff, lower body, 2 wings, perfect. They are now sinking into the earth a bit, getting settled more permanently, like they intend to stay, part of the landscape, much to my delight. On the path back to the car, I stopped briefly at the 2 wild rose bushes right at the turn as you leave the Bay Area and start heading back through the forest, flush now with their delicate pink single-layer blooms. More like floppy hats than the fluffed-up petticoat-type roses we cultivate in town. Then the partially bark-free cedar, the trunk underwood fully exposed for its first 15 feet or so. I have no idea how this happened, though I've seen documentaries in which indigenous people strip cedar bark in early spring, when it is lifted a bit from the trunk and slippery from all the leaf-feeding water pouring up and down beneath it. Bark they use to weave things together. The exposed wood is glass smooth, with one portion a series of rows of raised bumps like braille sentences. All so beautiful, you can't help but run your hand over it. Likewise for the huge, many-faceted boulder alongside the forest path about halfway around the loop, the only one anywhere in that portion of the woods, probably an afterthought of a great glacier eons ago, which on some summer days catches the sunlight at just the right angle, like a huge diamond, utterly mesmerizing. On the final stretch of the path, I met a mother with 2 young children just heading in, the girl about 5 years older than the boy. Such a happy-looking trio, who all smiled and said hi to me, reminding me of my own family 30 or so years ago. In the main lot, I said hello and commented in passing on the loveliness of the day to a man looking at the signage like this was his first visit. He asked me a question, and we ended up having a 5-minute conversation about the charms of this place. He was especially excited about the bats that roost down under the abandoned railway trestle, maroon now in the middle of the bay, I told him, and the rare prospect today of seeing that up close. His wife was sitting in the car. When we parted, he said he thought they would stay for a walk, which they had been trying to decide. So I did my bit to share at least the possibility that they, too, might be enveloped in the welcoming aura of selfless love that this generous place offers, at least from time to time, to anyone open to receive, give it.